again, and welcome back to the Slow Flowers Podcast with Deborah Prinzing, episode 231. This is the weekly podcast about American flowers and the people who grow and design with them. It's all about making a conscious choice, and I invite you to join the conversation and the creative community as we discuss the vital topics of saving our domestic flower farms and supporting a floral industry that relies on a safe, seasonal, and local supply of flowers and foliage. This podcast is brought to you by slowflowers.com, the free nationwide online directory to florists, shops, and studios who design with American-grown flowers, and to the farms that grow those blooms. It's the conscious choice for buying and sending flowers. This week's guest is Meredith Isaacson of Seattle-based Verde & Company, and I know you'll find her story inspiring. What's particularly intriguing to me is learning that Meredith will be opening her retail flower shop very soon. In a world that has witnessed the rapid decline of brick-and-mortar floral retail, well, here's a woman who is bucking that system. You'll learn why having a retail presence is important to Meredith's business plan, and you'll gain insights from her fascinating journey from one creative medium to another. Those personal experiences have shaped her aesthetic and her business philosophy. Meredith and I got together last week to record this pre-Valentine's Day interview. You'll want to follow along on her crazy whirlwind schedule as she races to open the doors of Verde & Company less than a week before February 14th, the peak American floral gift-giving holiday. And here's a little bit more about Meredith. Originally from New York, Meredith moved to Seattle in 2007 and dove headfirst into her floral design career, working for one of Seattle's premier floral studios. Verde & Company is a labor of love for Meredith, as she grew up in a family business that was founded in 1913 by her great-grandfather. Growing up, she gravitated toward helping her mom set the dinner table during holidays and going to work with her dad, as well as collecting unicorns. She thinks of designing as a dance, executing each floral with great technique infused with a true sense of artistry. Meredith lets the arch of the branch or the direction of the bloom dictate where the floral may take her. As an avid collector of unique and vintage vessels, she is always on the hunt for ways to create a personal experience for her clients. When not in her studio, Meredith enjoys cooking, spending time with her husband, and their two dogs, Toby and Stella. They often find themselves cuddled up on the couch with a good movie or out and about for a long walk around town. Please enjoy our conversation and visit deborahprinzing.com for our show notes, where you'll see photos of Meredith and her beautiful designs, as well as an architect's rendering of the just about to open new flower shop in Seattle's South Lake Union neighborhood. I also want you to check out the innovative campaign that Verde & Company has just launched on Seattle's Community Sourced Capital. This is not a crowdfunding effort, but instead a sustainable business financing model that uses a community of supporters to make interest-free loans to socially minded entrepreneurs. You'll hear more about this facet of Meredith's story in today's conversation, so let's get started. Welcome back to the Slow Flowers Podcast, and I'm delighted today to have my guest, Meredith Isaacson of Verde & Company. Hi, Meredith.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. Meredith and I know each other through the Seattle Wholesale Growers Market, and she's also a member of slowflowers.com, and we've been talking just on email and face-to-face, and hearing your story made me really want to get you in before Valentine's Day, and now, of course, you have some great news to share that is perfect for this episode, because why don't you go ahead and tell everyone what's happening next week?
So my shop is opening on February 8th, so that's a Monday, which is...
perfect timing, right before
Valentine's Day week, which is a little insane, but I'm really excited about it.
Yeah, so Verde & Company, tell us about your shop, where it is, and how large it is and that sort of thing.
Sure. We're on 400 Fairview Avenue North in South Lake Union. It's 400 square feet, and the building that we're in is a market hall style concept. So there's other retailers in there. There's a coffee shop, a juice bar, sandwiches. There'll be a few restaurants. So it's really a like a meeting place for people to come and have more of an experience.
Yeah, and you're saying South Lake Union, so people who aren't familiar with Seattle need to know this is the hip, happening, hot neighborhood where all the tech firms are moving into, right?
It is true, and this used to be where all the flower businesses were, where all the wholesalers were. In fact, this building is the old building for one of my wholesalers.
Now you have, like, Tommy Bahama is in the building. And
yes, it's all corporate offices up top. So we have Tommy Bahama, Impinj, which is a local Seattle company, and a couple other, I think, tenants that I can't quite remember the name of.
Oh,
right
but
now.
They're techie types.
Yeah.
And when you say market hall concept, is that sort of like this pedestrian sidewalk feeling? That's the feeling I got walking into the building.
Yeah. And what's great for the tenants, there are a lot of things that drew me to the space, but I love the fact that I have an entrance onto Fairview and I have an entrance in the market hall. So it kind of gives an open feeling, and the architecture in the building definitely lends to that quality.
It's very modern.
Yeah, it's very modern. So.
You mentioned when you showed me your space, and we just toured your space.
Under construction.
It's under construction. So Meredith is going to share the architecture renderings that we can put on the show notes.
Yeah.
You mentioned that everyone who works in that building has to walk in front of Verde and Company to get to their desks.
Yeah. So I when I looked at the availability in the plans, I selected the space because for the tenants in the building that come up through the garage, they can't get to their offices walking.
Yeah.
They have to walk past to get to the elevator bank for the offices. So,
And your storefront is going to be luring them in with all the beauty.
Yeah, well, it's great because I'm on like a little corner spot. So I have like a spillover area that's perfect for a riser with some buckets and kind of the grab and go. So we designed this space so that there is kind of an alcove for that, for people to kind of walk up and grab and go and check out. And then there's also more, they'll also be able to see all like designers working and creating and kind of walk by the cooler and see what's fresh.
Yeah, I got the sense that you wouldn't be getting bumped into by other people walking by. There's a little bit of a recess that people can step into.
Yes, there's a recess. And we also made sure that the designers, because I am one and I know it's nice to have a little bit of space, had some room to work without kind of being butted up against
by shoppers.
Yeah.
Well, we're dancing around what I think is the big story here, and that is that most people are closing brick and mortar flower shops these days, and I think that's really tragic. It's sad to see these mom and pop shops close, but many of them are decades old and really haven't progressed design-wise or product-wise. You're kind of the new generation of someone who's come out of studio design, and there's a place for lifestyle retail, and maybe that's why you're doing it. I'd love to have you to talk about what led you to this decision.
So I worked for another studio in Seattle for 6 years and then went out fully on my own last April. And
that's when you started the name Verde and Company.
That's when I started Verde and Company. Yeah.
I love that.
So I had been doing kind of event work supplemental to my other job for a long time, but this was really my launch as Verde and Company. And I was approached about this space, and I had been doing studio work. And what I really missed was not interacting with customers, not having kind of a personal experience and communicating with them, and not just dealing with meeting someone in a coffee shop to design an event or a vendor relationship.
Yeah. So, and even if you were doing weddings, it was sort of a one-time thing.
It's a one-time thing. Yeah. You don't really get to see somebody after that, although sometimes they do come to you. But this gives me an opportunity to be a flower shop where people call for flowers for holidays and birthdays and maybe sad occasions and happy occasions, or just because.
And also then if you have corporate clients, it might be weeklies or whatever.
Yeah, and that's part of what's great about this area is there is so much corporate business. So we're really hoping to access some of that.
It's interesting. There's corporate business, but there are a lot of residential apartment buildings too.
So the entire block.
Yeah. So on the weekends, you'll be open or?
Well, initially, no. We're going to be in a Monday through Friday shop. We're debating whether we're going to be 9 to 5 or 10 to 6 right now. Every day it's a new, 10 to 6, no 9 to 5. Still haven't decided.
So the building isn't forcing hours on you.
No, the building is not. I mean, they've requested requested that everybody be open to minimum and that, you know, there aren't like dark spots. But yeah, there is no forcing. So we will be closed on the weekends and until the block can support the business being open on the weekends.
Yeah, well, I have to say there's probably four cranes surrounding us right now. So maybe in a year, the landscape will look different.
Yeah, that's going to be an apartment building across right across the street. And then I think the Seattle Times building is going to be mixed.
Yeah, I mean, we're basically sitting in my car to get quiet space, but we're looking at the Space Needle. So that can kind of give people a sense of where Verde and Company is going to be. Well, I think it's great. I know of one other flower shop that opened, and that's Nisha Kellen, and her spot is 300 square feet. It's even slightly smaller than yours. Is 400 adequate to do what you need to do? It looks pretty nice.
Yeah, I think the way I work with Strata Architects in Wallingford, and they have been really fabulous, and they really worked well with me on figuring out flow and how to really utilize the space to go vertical for storage and really, you know.
Yeah, that's a good point because you have high
ceilings. Really high ceilings,
It's not even really a ceiling, is it?
No, it's kind of an open
beam.
Kind of thing. But
That's cool. Well, let's back up a little bit and talk about Meredith and your journey to floral, because everyone has such a unique story and yours is incredibly inspiring.
Oh, thanks.
You've had other creative pursuits before you came to flowers. Do you mind sharing that with people?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I grew up in New York and, was a ballet dancer for many, many years.
You said you started studying ballet at what age?
Well, I started studying ballet at 10. Before that, I did gymnastics, and so I started ballet because of that.
So all physical.
All physical. Yeah. And then I got tall, and it wasn't a good fit for my body anymore. So I really focused on ballet, and it really became the focus of my life. And at 16 years old, I changed schools and went to a special school in New York City called Professional Children's School.
Oh, yeah.
And,
wow. That's private.
It's private, It's not like a Fiero LaGuardia.
Okay, Wow.
And I went there for my last 2 years of high school and had a couple of professional jobs, and my life was down. I did not have a normal high school experience.
Because you either were in class or in the studio dancing.
Correct. And then I did guided study for some of my academics, too. I wouldn't trade it, though. But it was unique.
Yeah.
It was definitely unique.
You alluded to the fact that at some point you decided to close the door on that, though.
I did. When I was 19, I stopped dancing. I pretty much burned out. And it's kind of hard to imagine burning out at 19. But it's a really hard industry physically, emotionally, spiritually. It's just really, can be really difficult. So
it makes standing up all day making flowers for a wedding or event look like a piece of cake, right?
Well, yeah. it always makes me realize that I have a little more to, I can push myself, which can be a good and a bad thing.
Right.
But
you have that inner strength.
Yeah. I feel like I can always push myself a little bit harder.
So you were still living in New York City. You were kind of out of high school and trying a bunch of different jobs.
And
did you even think about being creative then?
I pretty much just shut the door to creativity when I kind of went dark on that for a really long time and tried to do what most people do is find themselves when they're 20.
Yeah.
You know,
takes a few laps around the track there.
Yeah. And started college at 25. I was working full time. I went to NYU and I studied psychology and then graduated at 31.
And when you were in college, you were an older student then.
I was an older student, night classes.
Really serious then, like you were paying for it, and so you had
student loans too, you know, those are fun.
So your goal at the time, were you thinking, I'm going to study psychology to do XYZ, or were you sure?
Yeah, I wanted to get a master's in social work.
Okay.
Either that or I wanted to go into research. I wasn't quite sure at the time. And so by the time I got done, it was 6 years later, I had to work for a good portion of it. I was really kind of exhausted and not as inspired to continue on. I did a little work in crisis intervention. That was really intense. And then my husband and I moved to Seattle in October of 2007. And I kind of had a clean slate to start from and a lot had changed for me.
Yeah.
And my husband has always encouraged and supported my creative endeavors. He's always encouraged me to do more.
So he's seen you as creative even when you weren't seeing yourself as creative.
Correct. He's always like, go get some watercolors, go paint, go do whatever. And the dancer in me was always like, it won't be perfect.
Yeah, there's no audience for this.
Yeah. So I took some floral design classes in Seattle and then said, hey, you know, why not try out the industry? And went on Craigslist and found a job at a studio washing buckets and delivering flowers and really kind of bottom up. And yeah.
Do you think you, can you pinpoint why you even took that first floral design class? Was it just a curiosity about something that you liked visually? Or?
For me, it was color. Mm-hmm. I've always been drawn to color in a way that I kind of can't really explain it, but flowers to me embody color in a very different way because of the shades that they have in them. Nothing is ever really one shade of a color.
That's true.
So I've always, that's just always been really compelling to me.
So you kind of dabbled and thought, oh, this might be just a fun class to learn, but it kind of pushed you to see if you could work in the industry.
Yeah. And when I took the class, I was so frustrated with myself because I didn't know how to do it all right away. Mm-hmm. And that's very much
the performer in you.
Yeah. I was like, you should be better at this. You know, I was really kind of hard on myself. and then realized that, you know, it's not only a process of, there's a lot of techniques and mechanics in floral design that you can learn and that I think you should learn at some point to be able to do certain things. But I do believe it's also an extension of who you are. So when I got a little bit more in touch with that, I feel like my floral design, it all kind of connected.
Oh, I love
that. In a different way.
And that's really an important thing to stop and just meditate on, just that the flowers come out of your hands and they are an expression of, if you're tense, they're going to be tense. If you're relaxed and, you know, happy, then they're going to have a different style, right?
Yeah, I think that, not to get too woo-woo on you, but, you know, I think it has a lot to do with energy and how, you know, the feel of the shop and the studio or wherever it's coming out of, and the intent and the purpose behind the person who's running the business.
So you indicated that at some point you kind of outgrew the style of the studio you were working for, mm-hmm. and you were ready to move on and do something on your own.
Yeah, I think I really felt like I wanted to branch out.
Mm-hmm. I love it.
But yeah,
no pun intended.
No pun intended. And we talked about this a little bit earlier, and I'll just touch on it. But as I branched out on my own, I really started to realize that there really is a bit of a dance in floral design. Mm-hmm. And when I think about what my people are, what's your style? You know, when I think about it, I always, like I said, think about color.
Yes.
But I also think that instead of dictating what the floral arrangement does, I allow the elements to dictate where it goes. And to me,
that's great.
Yeah.
Then every arrangement is basically going to have its own unique profile.
I do think that, but I also think that my arrangements are kind of identifiable by certain techniques that I use.
Yeah.
I work with a lot of roses.
Wow.
So I think that's one of the things that,
You know what? I'm having this image in my mind of you as finishing a dance performance and having that classic bouquet of roses being handed to the dancer. Did that happen for you at times in your life?
No, I never got that far along.
What?
But I did have family give me flowers. I never got that far along.
Oh, not from secret admirers?
I was never the 1% of the dancing community. No, I was never, you know, but...
But the rose, somehow it symbolizes...
Yeah, there's a connection there.
There are
other... I know a lot of other women that dance that work in floral design. There's
really
a definite connection there. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, you... when we were talking about designing the studio or the shop, you talked about working in front of a mirror. So describe that. I think that's a really interesting design distinction that you're going to have in the shop.
Yeah, I've actually worked like that in other places.
So what do? You stand at a table and look at a mirror?
Yeah, have the arrangement on like a Lazy Susan in front of the mirror. And when I was telling my husband about it, and he went to art school for sculpture and scientific illustration, he's like, oh, it's like we do in art school. And I've never been to art school.
Oh, so sculptors do that too.
Yeah. So it's really a great way to kind of spin the arrangement, look at it in the mirror, be able to kind of conceptualize, because now you're seeing it from the other person's point of view, not through your own eyes in the same way, which...
I have seen people who do wedding bouquets always go stand in front of the mirror to see how it's going to look as the bride is carrying it. But even for a vase arrangement, it sounds like a perfect idea.
Yeah, it's great.
So you're going to have these mirrors hanging in the shop.
Yeah, we have two of them, and we've decided to actually pitch them back a little bit this time.
So they'll tilt out a little bit.
Yeah, they're going to tilt a little bit out from the wall, which would be nice for the person working there. They can see what's going on behind them, and it'll give them a little bit. One thing I've noticed when the mirror's flat is you don't get to see the top.
Yes.
So it'll give you a little bit of a view of the top of the arrangement, which I thought would be great.
It reminds me of all the flower show demos I've done where the floral people are often put at the same demo stage as the chef demos, and all the chef demos have those tilting mirrors above them.
Yes.
And so it is a nice thing for the person in the back row to be seeing what you're looking down on or whatever.
Totally, yeah.
That's exciting. And I think that this whole idea of letting the materials create your form and your aesthetic is, I love the way you describe it, because we were talking about all the words that we don't want to use.
There's a lot of overuse of certain things.
Yeah. And it's hard because we love language and how many times can you say wild and foraged or whatever it is.
Yeah.
It's hard to figure out something distinct for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So I like talking about, in a way, this idea of letting the materials kind of create the line.
They do create the line.
Yeah. It kind of parallels up with your other philosophy about how you source mm-hmm. with local and seasonal products.
Yeah.
So can you talk a little bit about that too?
Sure. Yeah. We try to source locally and seasonally whenever possible. We talked about this.
Yeah.
Faced at times with not having enough or availability mm-hmm. of what we need.
Mm-hmm.
So we do source from other
wholesalers. Yeah.
Yeah. But one of the long-term goals of the shop is to eventually source all American-grown
mm-hmm.
flowers.
Mm-hmm.
And it does raise the cost of our goods mm-hmm. sometimes, but mm-hmm. I do hope that the people that are buying understand that what they're buying and that what they're spending their dollars on. So.
Well, I think that's going to be a challenge in a retail setting. Of course, you're in a kind of a high-end neighborhood,
mm-hmm.
but I think flowers in general suffer from this attitude that they're too expensive, and what's your competition? Your customer's going to Trader Joe's, and so you're going to have this education that hopefully will be positive, that people will understand the story behind the flowers you use. Luckily, it isn't necessarily a grocery store, so they'll see you as a couture boutique and somebody mm-hmm. who has more of an artistic approach.
Correct.
So I don't know what will you envision as your product mix? Will you have pre-made arrangements and then some things on made to order?
Sure, we're gonna have a selection of hand-tied, kind of craft paper wrapped, mm-hmm. Grab and go for the person that doesn't really have a lot of time. A few arrangements in different price points in the cooler for also the grab and go at a higher price
mm-hmm.
point, and then of course we can create made to order arrangement for delivery or for pickup. And we're actually working right now with a delivery service that we haven't signed on the dotted line with them yet, but they do it with like bicycles and stuff. So it was kind of fun to.
Well, in this district, there's probably a lot of food delivery already going on. So.
Yeah, yeah. I just when thinking about the shop, I'm just in the process of hiring my first employee. I've never had an employee before, which is really exciting and scary simultaneously, but I didn't really want to have to hire a delivery driver because
mm-hmm.
I'm not really sure so I wasn't really sure what that would look like. And
you kind of almost want an on-demand delivery.
Yeah. So I'm working with already established delivery services in Seattle to kind of create that, but we will be able to deliver to customers same day. So
that's
one of our goals. And then floral design classes.
Mm-hmm.
So
cool.
We're going to offer them in our shop, and then there's an event space in the building that can host. In our shop, we could probably host like 4 to 6.
Right.
But there's an event space in the building that's for all the tenants to use on, you can reserve it.
Oh, that's what we were talking about, maybe going
up
to see.
Yeah, there's a meeting in there today, but I'll have access to that for larger classes. And then eventually down the line, I would like to bring in designers from other areas to help foster education in the floral industry for other designers and people interested in actually learning become a designer.
Wow.
Because that was one of the things I got from Floral Design Institute. There isn't anything like that in Seattle right now. Right. And a lot of the classes offered are just kind of like a one-off, like learn how to, you know, there isn't any sort of building block. And I really
like the business of being a floral designer.
The business of being a florist. And I really feel like I'd like to support that.
Well, if you could kind of be this convener of the conversation and bring basically peers into the, you know, into the space and hear from people that you've invited, you'd be doing a huge service to the industry because there's so much, you know, being around the growers market, we know there's so much interest in getting involved in this, you know, burgeoning local flower movement. So there seems to be more people saying, hey, I want to try this. I want to buy flowers and create a little floral business, have a CSA or do dailies or, but where do those people learn the actual pricing and the business side? There are some people offering really great workshops on a specific topic, but not the whole gamut. So.
Yeah. There in New York, there's the Flower School, which offers like those really large classes that. So, which I think is great. But I think
there's room for it here.
There's room for it here. And I've learned so much talking to other designers about what they do. I mean, that's one of the great things about having these classes too, is the community of designers you could bring together if you had like a master class.
Right.
I mean, just as far as pricing, like it's nice to have that open dialogue, to have that conversation like, well, this is how I do things. Oh my God, that's a much better idea than what
right.
I do.
Right.
Not as much as of a competition, because I do believe there's enough business out there for all of us.
I agree completely. And I really think that if you know your brand and you know what your aesthetic is and your profile of your customer, you shouldn't worry about anybody else and what they're doing.
I agree. I think you should support other designers and what they're doing and be happy for them.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. No, we talked about this earlier in our lunch, but you know, this same analogy, I see it in the garden writing world, which I come from. It's like there is a huge percentage of people who want to be mutually supportive and a few who don't want to play in the sandbox. And, you know, you just have to accept that that's life and find the people who do want to play in your sandbox and help them and find a reciprocal way of, you know, really celebrating that.
Yeah.
All right. I want to end by asking you about Valentine's Day.
Okay.
You didn't know before we got together, we thought we were going to be talking about your pop-up shop
in the building.
Yes.
Yes. Cause we didn't think we were going to open in time.
So what, now you're opening the Monday of
this
Valentine's.
This is the first time I'm announcing it publicly.
Okay.
I've told a few people, you know, and you know, it's like, I don't want to jinx myself. Cause then once I say it, it's out there, but, I'm pretty confident in our contractor and.
So Monday, February 8th.
Yep, Monday, February 8th, we will open our doors, and I can't promise that it won't be a little crazy, but it'll be good.
Well, I'll come up and see you and maybe bring you a latte or something, or maybe I should bring you a mimosa. You're going to might need
some. Yeah, I don't know.
What will you have? What kind of product mix do you think you'll have that week?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So we have pre-ordered all of our kind of local seasonal products through the growers market and sourced, and then are basically going to use our wholesalers as our cooler for the rest of the week.
Okay.
And didn't pre-order a ton of other product.
So you'll probably shop every day.
I will be up at 4 or 5 o'clock every morning at the wholesale house shopping to fill.
Yeah.
So previously I've worked in places and done, you know, arrangements that are kind of have a recipe or
right.
You know, like, you know, it's going to look like this.
This is the Verde and Company Valentine's Day recipe or something.
Right. And so what we're doing, and I think this may become a part of how we do things, and I've been thinking a lot about this, is saying, you know, it's a seasonal mixed floral. This is the product we'll have available. Tell us your color preference and let us do.
I love that. Trust us.
Because it, unless you're, hey, if you want a dozen red roses, yes, we will do that. Absolutely. But it doesn't have to.
Right.
It could be a lot of other, there are a lot of other options. And maybe you don't want red or pink. Maybe you want green, white, and yellow, which is really beautiful.
So springy.
It doesn't, you know, flowers convey emotions no matter what color they are.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
You know.
I love that.
So.
I love the name Verde and Company.
Yeah.
I'm staring at your eyes. You have hazel green eyes.
Yeah.
And I do too. So
yeah,
maybe that's why I connected with you. You're wearing a great green bracelet.
My mom got me this.
It's oh my gosh.
Bakelite. She's the best vintage
consignment. I was gonna say, it's very vintage looking.
Yeah, it's Bakelite.
So is that where did Verde come from? I'm just guessing that there's some green.
Yeah, well, there's green there. But so I grew up, as I said, in New York, and my father is Italian. And this is kind of a nod back to that. It's also a nod to that culture, but I grew up in a family business that my great-grandfather started in 1913, and I worked there.
What business was it?
We worked in manufacturing, truck bodies for the food industry.
Oh, my gosh.
Insulated vehicles. It was a very, very special, unique upbringing, and I definitely was exposed to the struggles of a small business at a very, like, at a pretty young age, I think.
Right.
Which has made me acutely aware of the finances of making a business successful.
What a great education.
Yeah.
Before you became a ballet dancer.
Yeah.
Or at the same time.
Yeah, yeah. My mom's actually a musician, too. But I really wanted to nod back to that upbringing. Mm-hmm. I really wanted to nod back to my Italian culture. And I really wanted to nod to the family business, and I'm going to try not to get emotional here, because it really is the foundation of who I am.
Yeah, and your ethos,
yeah.
How you want to respect your employees and your customers.
Yes.
And you obviously learned that from your family.
I did, and I had a lot of different jobs throughout my life where I had good and bad experiences, and I took kind of an internal poll and said, what do I want this to look like for myself and the people that work there? So
that's neat.
That was really, you know, big for me. And, you know, when my great grandfather started the business, he had immigrated here from Italy and had struggles that I'll never understand.
Right.
But when I think it's hard, I realize it's not as hard as what he had to go through.
Absolutely.
You know, so, and speaking of that, we just launched a campaign today with community-sourced capital.
Oh.
To raise funds for working capital for the business.
Oh, cool. I'm so glad you mentioned this.
Yeah. So it is not, it is a loan.
Okay.
It is not a donation. And it will allow Verde & Company to continue to grow and do all the great things that we've talked about today. And if you log onto their website, and I'm going to put it on my Facebook page.
Okay,
and
I'll put the link on the show notes too.
Okay, you can purchase a square. They start at $50 a piece, and every month they make a payment back to the square. You get a dividend of that until you're fully paid back. So, the purpose of the loan is, like I said, to help us continue to grow the business with the cost of the build out. It has eaten into some of our working capital.
Absolutely.
So we're trying to recoup some of that. And the benefit of this type of loan versus a traditional bank loan, which is very hard for a business like mine to get, is this is at 0% interest to us.
Wow. So it's got a kind of a social awareness component to it.
Correct.
Or social betterment or whatever.
Right.
Yeah.
We're asking people who believe in us to invest in our business and that trust us that we will make that payment and pay you back over the 3-year period.
That's so cool.
So,
say the name of the.
It's Community Source Capital. They're down in Pioneer Square.
Wow.
And I've worked with some of the people over there. They've been absolutely great. And there's a lot of businesses in Seattle that have done it. Britt's Pickles did it. Pizzeria Gabbiano did it. I'm trying to think of
So small
incubator businesses.
Wow.
And we found at this point this was the best way to raise capital to keep us going at the rate that we're going.
Oh, well, I think this is a really fun model for people to learn about as well. I mean, I know we've seen the Indiegogo and the Kickstarter, but those aren't loans.
Right.
This is different.
This is a loan. This is not a donation. So every month we have to make a payment. We pay community source capital, and then you get a dividend of that depending on of how much you've donated.
Right.
So, and if the business does not make a payment, you're informed the business does not make a payment. So there is an accountability. And then we had to go through a process to become approved by them. So,
wow. Congratulations.
Yeah. Thanks. I'm excited. And, it's like a little bit of a pinch me moment at times, you know, is this really happening? It's been kind of a journey to get here. And
yes, because you originally thought you would open the store in the fall, right?
Yeah, we thought we were going to open in Thanksgiving, which I think is humorous now.
That seems like ancient history.
Yeah.
Oh, dear.
So, but, you know, I first stressed out a lot about it. I was like, oh, what are we going to do? We're missing that. And then I said, you know what? It's going to open when it's going to open. I can only do so much. And my architect echoed that, Amarina from Strata. She's like, I believe that. She's like, it's going to open when it's going to open. And we're just kind of, I say we went with the flow. We didn't not do anything.
Yeah.
We did all the work we could do.
You were rowing the boat, but yeah. You could only row it when there wasn't a ruck in the way.
I mean, you know, you're just stuck there.
And we're in a very vibrant marketplace, and you're competing against big corporations who are hiring contractors, and you're a small business. So that's another facet of it.
Yeah, it's been. And then the contractor I'm working with, Metis Construction, they are small. They're actually a cooperative now. They just went into a co-op. So it's a construction company that is actually a co-op of high craft workers.
Oh, my gosh.
So they're really cool.
You're walking the talk.
They are... they're great guys.
That's so cool. Well, we'll put those resources, whatever ones you can share, we'll put on my show notes. And also, I did take a few photos, but of course, it's a space that's not finished. So you're going to give me the rendering.
I'll give you the rendering.
And then let's show some of your work so people see that what Verde and Company is all about.
Okay, I can do that.
Okay. Yeah. This is great. Thanks so much, Meredith.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us this week. I have two announcements before we conclude. First, 2 weeks ago, our podcast guest was Ann Graves, Marketing Director of Syndicate Sales, who discussed American manufacturing and the American-made collection of vases from Syndicate's Kokomo, Indiana factory. Syndicate graciously donated a $100 shopping spree to one listener, and we have drawn a name from those of you who took the time to comment at the show notes on DeborahPrinzing.com. The prize goes to Cara Gilmartin of Cross Street Flower Farm in Norwell, Massachusetts, located on the south shore of Boston. Here's what Cara wrote in an email after we notified her of her win. Get out of town. I never win anything. And I was just filling in my business partner, Nikki Bartley, on Syndicate's products just yesterday. Anne, I look forward to talking to you. We are obviously huge fans of Slow Flowers. Cross Street shares the same mission and vision to be able to provide really awesome flowers for our community and educate about the importance of local agriculture. We look forward to joining the Slow Flowers family. Thank you so much for this amazing gift. Signed, Cara Gilmartin, Cross Street Flower Farm. Well, congratulations, Cara, and your partner, Nikki. And I, too, look forward to Cross Street Flower Farm joining the slowflowers.com community very, very soon. And a special thanks to Syndicate Sales for that generous donation. Second, for those of you who love beautiful and inspiring magazines, I want to introduce you to Garden Design. I've written for Garden Design for many years, including serving as contributing editor in 2009 and 2010 when I was based in Los Angeles. Many people feared that the best magazine for horticulture, plants, and landscape design was about to disappear when former owner Bonnier Corp folded the title in 2013. Not much later, though, a white knight arrived with Jim Peterson. Jim is a green industry entrepreneur and the creator of two online membership communities very similar and much, much larger to slowflowers.com. One is called Concrete Network and the other is called Landscape Network. So Jim and his team acquired the Garden Design brand and have published 6 gorgeous editions of Garden Design magazine since 2014. These plump bookazines are ones that you'll have on your shelf forever. What's notable is that Garden Design is ad-free, with 148 pages of vivid, high-quality photography printed on excellent paper stock. Not only am I a big supporter of Garden Design, the magazine staff has been super supportive of Slow Flowers and our mission. In fact, Jim and I have just cemented an agreement that allows us to showcase the design work of Slow Flowers members on the magazine's website and in its well-read newsletter 4 times throughout the coming year. As a special thank you to Slow Flowers members and listeners of this podcast, Garden Design has a subscription gift for you. Follow the link at DeborahPrinzing.com to receive 1 free issue when you subscribe to a year of the magazine. So that's 5 issues for the price of 4.
And if you subscribe now, you'll receive the early spring issue, which contains a feature story written by me. And that beautiful story, photographed by Claire Takas and written by me, is called Geometric Impact. It's about a Brandon Tyson-designed Bay Area landscape. Wild yet tame, old yet new, the Mediterranean landscape that he designed uses lush, colorful, and geometric-inspired plantings to entice an active family in the Bay Area outside. I can't wait to see that in print. Check out DeborahPrinzing.com to see a preview of the early spring issue's cover art. It ships in February. And I have to add a fun note, a comment from Jim when we were emailing each other this week. He wrote, "Deborah, taking a cue from you, maybe we should be the Slow Magazine. We're American-made, printed in the U.S., and offer high quality for those that appreciate and relish the tactile experience of holding a beautiful magazine in their hands." Well, I couldn't agree more. Thanks, Jim, and thanks, Garden Design Magazine. The Slow Flowers podcast has been downloaded more than 81,000 times by listeners like you. And we wrapped up January 2016 as the second highest month of listenership in this podcast's 2.5 year history, with more than 4,600 downloads. A great start to the new year. Thank you to each and every one of you for downloading, listening, commenting, and sharing. It means so much. Until next week, you're invited to join me in putting more American-grown flowers on the table, one vase at a time. And if you like what you hear, please consider logging onto iTunes and posting a listener review. The content and opinions expressed here are either mine alone or those of my guests alone, independent of any podcast sponsor or other person, company, or organization. The Slow Flowers podcast is engineered and edited by Andrew Wheatley and Hannah Holtgertz. Learn more about their work at shellandtree.com.